You are listening to The Great Leap Forward. My name is John Malkin, and this program is dedicated to exploring social change and spiritual growth, compassion, and anarchy. You can hear this program every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. here on Free Radio Santa Cruz and on the internet at www.freakradio.org. Free Radio Santa Cruz is a commercial-free, collectively-run radio station that has been broadcasting 24 hours a day without a license from the U.S. government for almost 10 years. This evening you will hear a very special interview with Venerable Kirti Tsenchab Rinpoche. Kirti Tsenchab Rinpoche was born in the province of Amdo, eastern Tibet, in 1926, and at age 6 was recognized as the reincarnation of the former abbot of the Kirti Gompa. At the age of 9, he was ordained as a monk. When he was 32 and completed his monastic studies, he was appointed as the abbot, the leader of Kirti. After escaping from Tibet in 1959, Kirti Tsenchab Rinpoche taught Tibetan orphans at the Tibetan Children's Village in Dharamsala, India. At the age of 45, he began a 15-year meditation retreat in a small stone hermitage above Dharamsala, quote, big enough for a bed, prostrations, and a stove. He spent 7 years in meditation on Lam Rim, 3 years on seven-point thought transformation, and some generation and completion stage tantra. 2 years were spent only on generation and completion stages, and in the final 3 years, Rinpoche repeated all of the above. It was after His Holiness the Dalai Lama requested that Rinpoche come out of retreat and teach that Kirti Tsenchab Rinpoche ended his retreat. Kirti Tsenchab Rinpoche is one of the teachers of the Dalai Lama and of Lama Zopa Rinpoche. This interview was recorded on October 1st, 2003 at Vajrapani Institute in Boulder Creek, California. I just want to tell you that I'm grateful for this time, Vola and Rinpoche. I'm grateful to be sitting here with you. Thank you very much.
Right. My name is Vula Sarpani. I come from Greece, and I have been working as Rinpoche's interpreter for the last 3 years. Some six years ago, I joined the translator's course, which is called the Lhotsawa Rinzen Zambo in Dharamsala. It is an FBMT course, and the aim was to produce qualified Dharma translators that could serve the lamas. So having completed that study there, I continued with developing my skills and eventually ended up with that particular job.
Thank you for making yourself available for translation, because my Tibetan is not so good.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's my pleasure.
The first question I have for Kirti Tsenchab Rinpoche: the Buddhist Dharma has the reputation of itself changing and transforming as the teachings settle in various parts of this planet. It affects each culture differently and is also affected by each culture. What in particular do you see Buddhism offering to the United States, and what do you feel the United States is offering to Buddhism?
We start, first of all, describing how Buddhist teachings appeared and spread into this world. We see that initially they appeared in India. From India they spread to China. From China they went to Tibet. From Tibet to Mongolia and some other countries in the Asian Peninsula. Now, after 1959, where His Holiness the Dalai Lama came into India as a refugee, we can see that a second era of spreading of Buddhism started, because from that point onwards His Holiness started traveling into the West. So America and Europe and so forth, they fall into the second, let's say, the second wave of transmission of the Buddhist teachings.
Or
It is already stated within Buddhism itself as an advice of the Buddha that when the Dharma, when the Buddhist teachings are given to different groups of people, one always has to take into consideration the, let's say, the differences in the character of the people, their language, their tradition, their aspirations, their psychological makeup. So Buddhist teachings themselves, they always have to be presented in a different way according to those who receive it. Of course, the idea is that one would never adulterate or change Dharma, the teachings themselves, but the presentation has to be in accordance with the needs of those who receive it. This is an advice that already exists within Buddhism. So taking that into consideration, briefly or roughly, one can divide countries into groups. Those who already have, let's say, strong religious sentiment, and those countries who are indifferent or do not have very strong religious tradition. If you go into a country where religion in general is not something which is common, you know, commonly respected or is very well developed, then you have to give some very basic advice, because you have to first of all build the foundation and then progress from that. If you go into a country where one religion system has already been very popular, then you have to take that into consideration and, let's say, alter a little bit the way that you present and always use some of their terminology, always use some of their values. You have to incorporate that into your teachings. The Buddha himself had said straight from the beginning that the teacher must show great discrimination when deciding to whom they should give teachings and what sort of teachings are available for a particular audience. And it is said that if one is addressing a public, people who do not have interest in religion, non-religious people, then you just cannot give them religious advice. You can give some public talk, some general talk, some general thing, but you don't really teach them Dharma. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama follows that advice quite closely, and that, of course, sets the example. So if you have just a group of people who do not have interest in religion, you will not try to enforce any religious advice on them. On the other hand, if you find yourself in a country where people have strong religious feelings, like, you know, some countries where the Catholic Church has been very strong and people have strong faith and so forth, you can build up on that, and you can, for example, draw attention from the fact that within Christianity we have the Ten Commands. Well, within Buddhism we have the 10 non-virtuous actions that need to be abandoned, and just draw on the similarity and that and try to build up from that way. So, you see, you always try to judge your audience, to always try to judge how receptive the people are, which level they are. The Buddha has said that the actual Buddhist teachings are given to those who already have some faith and interest in religion, and those whose conduct and behavior is well-mannered, well-moderated, polite people, respectful people. These are the ones who are open to receive Buddhist teachings.
And
as I say, we have to discriminate between countries who have interest in religion in general, those who do not have any interest. And finally, we can deal with a group of countries that traditionally were Buddhist countries. Now, within that, again, we see that there are some Buddhist teachings that have spread everywhere, some other teachings that only spread in particular areas. And there is a lot of dispute, of course, whether teachings of the lesser vehicle or whether teachings of the great vehicle, whether they represent the totality of Buddhist teachings, whether it was something that was fabricated later on, and so forth. There are a lot of countries where only the what we describe as the lesser vehicle teachings had spread. And in those countries, you see that there is a lot of resistance for Mahayana or great vehicle teachings, as well as tantric teachings. So they would say that the great vehicle teachings are not teachings originally given by the Buddha, that they were given by Nagarjuna, one of the great disciples. And further on, when they discuss the tantric teachings, they completely deny that they are Buddhist teachings at all. They say that they are Hindu teachings. So you can see there are particular areas in let's say, the Buddhist world where some group of teachings are not accepted as authentic teachings. In other areas of the world, yet not only do you have Hinayana, but you also have Mahayana. On top of that, you have tantric teachings. So you can see, depending on the area you find yourself, you have to moderate and adjust your presentation. So we come now to the later phase of the spreading of the Buddhist teachings, which involves spreading in Europe and America. His Holiness the Dalai Lama has made the observation that you can see that in those countries, Buddhism is spreading very quickly and there is a lot of interest. And that seems to be coming from the point, from the fact that Buddhism has this scientific view. It has this approach to things that seems to be very scientific, that everything needs to be examined, everything needs to be analyzed, and one needs to follow logic in order to establish certain values. And due to this scientific approach, most people, in a sense, welcome Buddhism. Now, when we talk about Buddhism, we have to look at it from two points of view. One is the view itself, and the view in Buddhism is a peaceful view, is the view that tries to avoid cruelty. That's the most important thing in I talked about view. That's the conduct, and that's actually our conduct, the way we behave. We try to behave in a peaceful way. We try to avoid cruelty in any possible way. When it comes to our view, we try to have as much a scientific view as possible. Now, the principle with that is the principle of analysis, that you need to examine things, you need to use logic, and if they make sense, then you accept those things that you have proven and you continue further. The most important thing we need to analyze within Buddhism is the mind. So the mind needs to be analyzed in a scientific way. Now, although we say that the view is a scientific view and the approach is a scientific analysis, then at the same time we have to understand that science has its limitation. And the limitation lies in the fact that science would only acknowledge things that are measurable directly with direct perceptions. And when it comes to philosophy, there are certain issues that they're not obvious, that cannot be obviously easily perceived. There are some hidden phenomena, and further than that, we have the very hidden phenomena. And you need to rely on clairvoyance or omniscience of a Buddha for those matters to be revealed. So when it comes to that depth, we say that we do rely on clairvoyance or the higher perception of the Buddha to explain these points. Now, how we can benefit from each other? Well, Buddhism can actually offer quite a lot of advice about the mind. And because the analysis is scientific analysis, this can be adopted by a modern Western society. Although there is a lot of research about the brain and the mind and its function within the Western society, still Buddhism has investigated those areas for a great number of years. So it has a great wealth of information to offer in that. And of course, the West can always keep offering back to Buddhism, let's say, a feedback as to how scientific the approach is and how clear the logic is, and so forth. So definitely there is some interaction and there is some mutual benefit in this giving and taking. Another area that can that's something else that Tibet has to offer into the world is its medical tradition. Now, Tibet is a very remote area. It's very high up in the world. That's why it's called the roof of the world. And because of its altitude and its specific geographic location, it has some endemic species of plants. And over the centuries, they have developed their own medicinal system. Now, there are many cases where Western medicine does not work, or it can work but cause side effects and so forth. And Tibetan medicine, it can be very effective without being so intrusive to the whole system. So definitely medical advice and medicine can be, some information in this area can be changed. Another interesting area is the area of ecology and environment, because you see that in the West, of course, you know, there's so much awareness and the need to keep everything clean, to maintain everything. But in a sense, there's no, let's say the explanation is like, oh, because it's nice to have it clean, right? But yes, but why, really? Now, within the Tibetan tradition, we accept that in everywhere in the environment, there are different types of beings, and those beings actually share the environment. So apart from humans, you have non-human beings. And definitely you have deities associated with water, with the earth, with the trees, and so forth. So every time you have a spring or a river or even the ocean, you have the deities of water who abide in the water, and in a sense they have to take care of the water. So if you go there and pollute, you are definitely insulting them and you are depriving them of their divine environment. So if you want to maintain a sense of balance in this world, if you understand that you have to share it, then it becomes important to approach water with respect. Now the same thing happens with the land. They are special beings who are the owners of the land, like non-human beings, and you need to respect their environment. The same thing happens with trees. You cannot just go around and log trees as you like without respect and without asking permission or without offering something back. So in order to maintain an equilibrium, if you can understand that you're sharing this world, then your view about environment will also change. Now another important area is peace, and how do you bring peace in this world? We know that these days we are suffering, not just these days, you know, since the beginning of time. There has been conflict, there has been war, and there is always one place or another in this earth at any given time that is suffering from this condition. And we say that in order to allow peace to prevail, you have to respect life. And when it comes to life, most people think that really it refers to human life, but it does not end there, because you have to respect the lives of animals as well. You have to respect like the deers and all the animals that live in the forest, and you have to respect all the fish and all the forms of life. No matter how small an animal might be, still they have life, and this life is important. This life is precious. So every time you take away life, you are engaging in act which is against peace. You cannot establish peace by taking life. And it doesn't stop with humans. You have to respect these animals as well. Now, there are cases we know where, for example, in order to use meat, in order to sustain ourselves, we do have to engage in act of killing. But most people can sustain themselves without having to go out for deer hunting or to go fishing, for example, right? So unless you live in a remote area where definitely you need to rely on hunting and fishing for your protein, for the rest of us, we really have to make sure that we limit activities such as hunting and fishing. For example, in Tibet, there used to be by law, you could not go out, hunt deer, or you could not go into the river and catch any fish, because that was considered as an act that would contribute to war and to conflict. It was definitely not contributing to peace. So one needs to be aware of those things. So maybe that's a little bit of advice that one can borrow from Buddhism and bring into the Western society too. Since we started talking about peace and advice on how to achieve that on different levels, I'm sure we're saying one needs to understand the environment as being an environment that has been established when the different elements are in balance. And we have the elements of earth, of water, of fire, and wind. And for each one of those elements, you also have deities that are associated with them. Now, we have a very clear idea of how imbalanced the environment is these days, because you see in some countries you might have earthquakes, which is an indication that the earth element is not balanced. In other elements, you have those huge fires that might burn, you know, for weeks, which means the fire element is imbalanced. In other places, you might either have very strong rains or you might be completely missing rain, means the water is imbalanced. And in other places, you might have typhoons and very strong winds. And you can see that people do suffer from that. And when you have indications like that, it seems that the deities associated with the elements are not pleased. And what that, of course, you know, when you analyze that, it makes you think that if I am to carry any activity in the environment, I have to, first of all, appropriate the deities of the different elements. So if I want to cut down a tree, I first have to invoke the deity of the tree and explain to them that this is my plan and ask for permission to continue. And as I'm cutting down the tree, I also have to offer something back to the deity. Otherwise, if the deity is displeased, then there some problem will arise. If I want, for example, to dig in the earth, again, I have to do the same thing. There are nagas, there are no humans, there are many spirits associated with the earth, and they all have to be appropriated and pleased. If you can explain to them what your plans are, and if you can offer a little present back, then things will remain balanced. And in Tibetan Buddhism, there are so many ceremonies and there are so many ways of offering something back to these deities to keep things balanced and at bay. You can see in brief, you know, in Buddhism, as we say, we always try to bring about peace, we always try to avoid harming others. And this is not just humans, there are many types of deities and gods, so forth. There are nagas, there are many different types of spirits. So in every time you carry out an activity, you have to think, how would this affect everybody else? I will try not to cause any harm, but if it is a situation where someone would be harmed, how can I minimize this? How can I rectify things? This whole thing of practicing method and wisdom in Buddhism and uniting this, well, it really leads down to a point like this. How do you apply this wisdom? What is the method that we minimize or completely avoid the harm? This is the essence of the philosophy, and this is the essence of our practice. Of course, it could be expanded if you wanted.
In 1959, Rinpoche fled Tibet due to the Chinese government's occupation of Tibet. I have the perception that it's been a very important time for Buddhism since that occupation started. And ironically, it's led to the great spreading of the Buddhist Dharma, especially to the West, especially to the United States. And it seems beneficial in that way, and yet it is a destruction of people. I wonder what the Rinpoche's feeling is about that period of time that we're in and the situation in Tibet.
Everything comes down to a question about one's karma and one's merit. And we have to say that if Tibet and if Tibetans are suffering and have suffered, it's because they have created the cause for that. They have created the karma for that. Tibet has been a Buddhist country for a very, very long time, but it doesn't mean that everything was running well in that country. And when we talk about karma, it is very important to talk about the individual karma, which is private karma, and the shared karma of the community, of the whole country. And you can see that Tibetans as a group, as a country, they have created the karma to later on have to experience such a tragedy causing so much destruction in their own country. Now, within this era of destruction and oppression and so forth, you can see some individuals, they got away with very little suffering. They escaped, they re-established the wealth, they continued their lives, and that shows you that there are cases of individual karma that was pretty well established. It was done in, virtuous karma has been accumulated, so although you might find yourself amidst a situation in an era of suffering and destruction, still, you know, you can go away and have a relatively good life and can escape all that. Now, this is what is happening in Tibet, right? From the point of view of Westerners, it has already been prophesied by the Buddha that about 2,500 years after the teachings will originally appear in India, so after that period of time, gradually the teachings will move into the West. That had been prophesied by the omniscient mind of the Buddha. So we have the prophecy, and now we can see the fulfillment of the prophecy. So people in the West have somehow created the causes to receive these Buddhist teachings, and also they have accumulated the merit to have a situation where peace is established, because in the West we operate within peaceful countries. When you go to Tibet, it's not peaceful. So if we look at the role of the Chinese are just the condition, and they operate, they serve, let's say, different groups in a different way. They serve the Tibetans who have created all this negative karma. They serve them as a condition that allows them to experience destruction. They serve the Westerners in a very kind, in a very beneficial way, because they were the condition that allowed Buddhist teachings to come out of Tibet and India and come into the West. The Chinese are the condition, and according to the causes that one has created, they will serve you in one way or another. Ursus says, I will give you another example. You might have seen this quite popular icon of Buddhist iconography, which depicts Buddha in Bodh Gaya just, let's say, a few minutes just prior to enlightenment. And he is attacked at that point by the Maras, by the demons. They attack him with various weapons, with spears and arrows and so forth. The Buddha, from his own side, is meditating on love and compassion, so he's totally unharmed by that. So there it is, at the same place, at the same time, you have two parties interacting, and one is trying to cause harm, but the other party is not receiving this as any harm. Noji is saying is this is exactly the result of one's karma, what causes you have created, what causes you have established. Now, in our own minds and in our own lives, there's a constant struggle between virtue and non-virtue. And it's like we are a state always on the verge of elections. And you have different parties, right? Some will be the opposition parties, some will be the supporting parties, and there is this constant conflict and power struggle. And eventually, one will win and the other one will lose. And, you know, the one who wins is the one who establishes the government and rules the place. This thing happens constantly within our own minds between virtue and non-virtue. Now, in the West, people are so fortunate to have had this, you know, peaceful side, virtue side, being triumphant. And this is why, although you might have a certain activity that can be perceived as an activity that is trying to cause harm to Dharma, you perceive it as beneficial. From the other side, it is perceived as being harmful. Now, if we look at it from another point of view, if we look at practices of the great vehicle of the Mahayana, every practitioner needs to go through a very long process of totally refining every aspect of their activity. And technically, this is called establishing the six perfections. So you have to perfect your generosity, you have to perfect your patience, you have to perfect your enthusiastic effort, and so on and so forth. You have to perfect reject all these aspects, totally, you know, bring them at an ultimate state so you can interact with others and bring benefit to everyone. Now, it is said very clearly in the scriptures, and you can see it for yourself. If you want to practice patience, you must have someone who is irritating you. If you don't have an irritating factor or being or something, how could you possibly develop your patience? How could you practice your patience, right? So you can see it from that perspective as well, that there are certain beings or certain conditions that manifest outside, and they're just opportunities for you to develop yourself further. When we talk about enemies, one always must make the distinction between what is the external enemy and what is the internal enemy. The external enemy is not so important, doesn't have that much power. It's the internal enemy within the mind, within the battle that takes care in one's own mind. That's the most crucial one. That's the most crucial battle to win. That's the most important enemy to overcome. So you can see, really, you know, what can be perceived as a difficult situation can actually serve you, and all these people who seem to be, you know, causing obstacle to you, they might be actually be out there to serve you in order to develop an aspect of your conduct. So, you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has been asked more or less the same question a few times, like, don't you get angry with a Chinese? Doesn't that infuriate you? And His Holiness has said, I'm not going to say that there has not been instances where some Tibetans got angry. You know, anger might arise, but these are examples of people who failed in their test of patience. Otherwise, one needs to understand that whatever suffering one is experiencing, one has created the causes for that thing personally. So there's no point in getting angry at somebody else for something you have created for yourself. Now, this is one way of relating to the whole situation and the Chinese and their invasion and the destruction of Tibet without trying to remain cool and maintain one's patience. On the other hand, it becomes very important to know the historical facts, to know that Tibet was a country that was independent, that was operating, that was recognized as an independent country, that it was invaded by the Chinese, that it was forcefully taken over by the Chinese, and to be able to present those facts clearly to the West, to whether you talk to government, whether you talk to an organization or to ordinary people, just to let them know clearly that we had a country that was independent and that was functioning very well, and it was taken over by force by the Chinese. Now, these are two different issues.
Rinpoche mentioned the prophecy by the Buddha that in about 2,500 years the Dharma would spread to the West. And I am interested in hearing about the prophecy of the Shambhala warriors and his relationship to that tradition or that notion. And in general, he's touched on this idea just in what he, in the end of his last answer, that the relationship of spirituality or religion and social change or politics, and often in the West, my view is that people often feel they need to choose between one or the other, and extremes of these views have developed over the years, with some people feeling really action is not so important, maybe meditation or reflection are important, or vice versa. So I would like to hear about these two things, the prophecy of the Shambhala, and also his view on the relationship between spirituality and social action.
First of all, we're talking about Rinpoche's connection with Shambhala. Of course, the Shambhala is through the Kalachakra Tantra, the Kalachakra deity. And Rinpoche said, I will tell you how many times I have bestowed the Kalachakra empowerment in America, in the West, all over the world, and maybe that will give you an idea. So in North America, the empowerment has been, by Rinpoche, has been given seven times in North America. Then if you add the times that it was given in South America, such as, you know, starting from Mexico, Puerto Rico, Colombia, and so forth, the Brazil, and so forth, it goes up to 12. Then if you add another seven times it was given in Europe, another five or six times it's given in different Asian countries. Then this year it was also given in Russia, in St. Petersburg. Then you can see that Rinpoche has actually given the Kalachakra empowerment so many times. So that on its own should be an indication that, yes, there is a connection between Rinpoche and Kalachakra. And if you have such a connection with Kalachakra, you have a connection with Shambhala. The prophecy of Shambhala, and there's quite a lot of chronology and a few names involved into that. Now, first of all, let's talk about the Kalachakra Tantra. The Kalachakra Tantra, the initiation and the root tantra, was given from Buddha Shakyamuni as an empowerment that was passed down to King Suchandra. King Suchandra was the king of Shambhala, and together with his main ministers, about 86 of his ministers, he proceeded to the land where Buddha was abiding. At that time, he was abiding in India, and he requested this initiation. The initiation was given within the Dhanyataka Stupa. The actual location of this place is not 100% verified. Some people say it's in South India. Some say it might be in Borobudur in Indonesia. Nevertheless, at that particular time, the empowerment and the root tantra were transmitted from the Buddha to the king of Shambhala. And at that time also, the Buddha made a prophecy addressing one of the bodhisattvas, and he said to Bodhisattva Manjushri that 600 years from now, there will be the need for you to compose a more condensed tantra, because the root tantra that I just gave out, is it will become too difficult and too complicated for other beings to practice. So King Suchandra went back into Shambhala with the empowerment, the practice, the commentaries, and so forth. And he was succeeded by six Dharma kings. Each one of those six Dharma kings remained, ruled for 100 years. So we went through a period of 600 years. And right after that, we start another period with what is called the period of the Kalkin kings. And the first Kalkin king was Manjushri Kirti. And you can see from his name, he had some connection with Manjushri. Actually, he said to be an emanation of Manjushri. And at his time, the need arose for the condensed commentary. So an emanation of Manjushri 600 years later, after the prophecy was given, composed the condensed tantra of the Kalachakra. Now, at the same time, it was explained that when we talk about Shambhala, Shambhala is the pure land where one practices mainly the Kalachakra. And one can identify the internal Shambhala and the external Shambhala. External Shambhala is a place that is found somewhere up in the north. Internal Shambhala exists within one's own mind. And it is said that there are always enemies to Shambhala, and they are those barbarians. They are the external barbarians and the internal barbarians. And there's always this fight, a constant struggle between the Shambhala practitioners and the barbarians. Now, as for the external location of the barbarians, it was said that their main area is Mecca. And we identify these days, you know, we have the name of this location exists. We know it exists within Saudi Arabia. Now, it is said that 600 years after the original bestowal of the initiation, an emanation of Manjushri will compose the condensed tantra. And when this happened, he was, as we say, we started with the era of 25 Kalkin kings. He was the first Kalkin king who did that. And it was said that he would be succeeded by another 24, so we end up with a total of 25. The Buddha actually prophesied again to Manjushri, and he said, you will appear as the first Kalkin king, where you will do this job of condensing the tantra. You will later on manifest again as the last, the 25th Kalkin king, and this you will have a wrathful emanation at that time, because at your time the big conflict between the Shambhala warriors and the barbarians will take place. Now, the question is, how do we calculate the time? How do we do the time calculations, right? Now, it is said that there are two ways of calculating a year, right? You can either count a year as being 12 months, or you can count a year as being 6 months. This is according to some ancient scriptures. So that's the reason why we're in doubt as exactly when this big war will take place. Now, if we calculate the year as being 12 months, and we start from the initial time of the empowerment, and we end up the 600 years of these first six Dharma kings, taking into consideration that every king more or less rules for 100 years, and we count down the Kalkin kings, we're now at the time of the 21st Kalkin king. So it means that in about 300 years, there will be the time of the 25th. And this is the time of the big conflict. Now, in total, that would give us a total of 2,900 years from the time that the empowerment was given and the prophecies were given. The point is, we don't know whether we should count the year as being 12 months or 6 months. If you count it as being 6 months, the time of the conflict is right now. It has started. If you read the whole prophecy, it says that at the time of the 25th Kalika king, who would be a wrathful emanation of Manjushri, the big war will break out. The battlefield will be next to the river Sita, and at that time, the armies of Shambhala will descend from the skies and so forth. You know, this is an epic description of all that. Now, River Sita most probably is in nowadays Pakistan. So sometimes we worry when there is something happening in Pakistan.
There is a lot happening in that area of the world right now.
When the Americans went into Iraq, Rinpoche said, I was quite alarmed because I thought, that's it, you know, there's not so much distance between Iraq and Pakistan, so here we are. One can never be sure.
I wonder if you can ask him about the relationship between spirituality and social change, even the idea of should I address my own suffering or should I address the suffering of the world? And can you do both? Do you need to do one before you do the other? People have these kinds of questions often.
Rinpoche says that actually there's no contradiction between those two views and there should be no conflict between them. But in a sense, you can see how well they reflect the two vehicles of Buddhism, Hinayana and Mahayana. Hinayana practitioners of the lesser vehicle are the beings who say, let me first get rid of my own suffering. Let me attain my own liberation. And as for getting rid or eliminating the suffering of others, this is too big a job. So let's see if I can attain my own happiness and liberation. And after that, let's see what happens after that. But the main goal is to take care of one's own suffering. Mahayana practitioners, they think in a different way. It is called the great vehicle because one is interested in taking care of the needs of a great number of other sentient beings, right? So one thinks that if I can work for the benefit of others, if I can work towards eliminating the suffering of others, as a byproduct, my suffering will be eliminated. My needs will be taken care of because I'm not an individual that exists independently. I exist within a society. So my well-being exists is found within the well-being of society. So if I can help the society, it means I'm helping myself. So there's no need for a contradiction, really. I'm sorry, I have to use this term. I know it's loaded, but we have to talk about globalization in the sense that there is not one single country, there is not one single community that these days can exist and operate without relying on the rest of the world. We have become so much interconnected that you see that you could not possibly, let's say in one ministry or in one organization, in one little office, have one person who thinks, I will only do my own little business. It just doesn't work like that anymore. Whatever you do affects so many people, not just in your country, but in many countries. Therefore, it's quite important to actually take that into consideration, to have a picture of the whole world, to try to keep the whole world into your mind, into your heart, when you schedule your activities, when you go out to work, because you know what you do will affect others. And eventually, if you do something and it does have the effects, and you can, if you can become aware of how many people, how many beings are benefited in different levels and through the course of time by one single activity, then really you can understand this vastness, you know, this greatness of the great vehicle that we always try to bring about the happiness and the well-being of others. And you reap such great results, such great benefits, and so much satisfaction for yourself, that then there is no question of you being left out or you being the victim and everybody enjoying something good and, you know, you not having that because you work for society, because you work for the benefit of others. You are also taking care, and actually usually you're taking care in the most great and grateful and graceful way.
I'd like to ask about fear and anger, difficult emotions for people often. And in Western psychology, fear and anger are often viewed as disturbing but normal, necessary human emotions. Often the goal is to limit the impact that these feelings have upon ourselves and others. And I'd like to know the Rinpoche's view on the most beneficial path to freedom from destructive emotions. And does he believe that it's possible to be completely relieved from the seeds of fear and anger?
First, he's saying we talk about these states of mind such as fear and anger and confusion and attachment, things like that. And as you say, they seem to arise naturally. For sure, we can say that they arise quite often, but whether it is natural, you know, naturally they exist within the mind or not, that needs to be examined. Because if you say that something naturally exists there, you're almost implying that there are no causes that can bring that about, right? And what we say is that, yes, they come up very often, but they come because there are certain causes and conditions that allow them to generate them. We have accumulated a lot of negative karma, and we have great familiarity with these types of minds, and we do not recognize them necessarily as being mistaken minds, minds that actually fool us, that they lead us to places we don't want to be. And as long as you don't recognize that, as long as you say, oh, it naturally arises, you don't do anything about it. If you approach it from another point of view, if you recognize that you have been fooled by your anger, you have been fooled by your ignorance, and you try to find the cause for that thing, then if you can recognize that cause, you can eliminate it.
Yes,
The great saint and master Shantideva has composed a text which is called Engaging the Bodhisattva's Ways of Life, and in that he has a whole chapter, which is the longest chapter, on patience. And of course he examines anger and how anger arises, and he says there are so many reasons why we get angry. Sometimes we get angry with ourselves, sometimes we get angry with others, we might get angry due to a facial expression, we might get angry due to some words that someone has uttered, certain behavior. There are so many things that irritate us. Sometimes we even get angry at inanimate things, right? You know, you get angry at your cup, right? You smash your cup and things like that. He says, but really, you have to ask yourself, what is the cause of anger? What is the source of anger? And whether it is that external being or object that really is the cause of your anger. And really, if you examine, you find that anger, the cause of anger is found inside you. It's this negative karma that you have created, that you have eliminated, that you have accumulated over so many lifetimes. And because you have familiarity with that, you generate it so easily. If you can identify that this is the cause, then you can start reversing the process and say, well, it's not appropriate for me to get angry at this person. It's not appropriate to get angry at myself. It's not appropriate to get angry at inanimate objects, and so forth. And in this process, once you start reversing it, you will see that you will gradually reduce the strength of anger, and eventually you come to a point where you completely eliminate
it. I want to thank Rinpoche very, very much for being here with me. I'm very grateful. And I know that his teachings benefit people all over the world. And my hope is that this interview and these words that have been captured will benefit many, many more people.
As he was saying, I totally agree with you, and this is why I have given this interview. And the last thing we were discussing was about anger and how to be patient. And as he was saying, I was quoting from this great saint, Shantideva, and his work, Engaging in Bodhisattva's Place of Life. I don't know if everyone who will hear it will understand it or benefit from it, but I'm sure some will.
And Vola, I'm very grateful for your time also and your capability in translating. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Kirti Tsenshab Rinpoche that was recorded at Vajrapani Institute in October 2003. For more information about Free Radio Santa Cruz, go to www.freakradio.org. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Our voicemail number is 831-427-4523. The studio number is 427-FRSC. Free Radio Santa Cruz is a commercial-free, collectively run radio station that has been broadcasting for almost 10 years without a license from the U.S. government. Special thanks to Skidmark Bob for production and editing of this interview.